Accession number 17840, Reel 4.
Arthur Morris, Reel 4. You were saying the candles were...
Yes, they invited us in to have this cup of tea with them, and obviously to talk over what they had seen or what they knew. And we observed that they had white cloths on the tables and some form of a candlestick with candles stuck in it on their table. And of course, as British troops, infantry troops in particular, seeing this sort of thing, more or less in what we considered was the front line, thought it was a typical American. You know, luxury right up to the sort of... the front line, which obviously by this time it wasn't, but that's what it appeared to us. Very free and easy going.
And next?
Well, of course, by this time, things were getting far easier as far as the normal fighting was concerned. We were covering a hell of a lot of ground, not only in meters, but, you know, in kilometers by this time. And it was a case of long runs, mostly the whole regiment of whatever they were at that time, sort of 400, 500, 600 soldiers, getting on tanks and making a beeline for an area some 40, 50, 60 miles away. The war had although taken the time to get to this particular area, it seemed to have the fighting, hand-to-hand fighting, of course, had long gone, but the fighting in itself had gone. So it was pockets of resistance more than a battle that we had to contend with, and they were looking back on reflection. They were very few and far between anyway. I think. By this time, the Germans had sort of given up, and the prisoners that had been taken was taken back for questioning as usual, and little odd things might have happened, which one doesn't recollect after these years, but. Eventually, the war had sort of come to the end of its tether. It was as far as I think the troops, I think one would agree that the war for us, although it was a few months in battle, in actual fact, we had a hell of a lot of ground to cover with no battle at all. It was just a matter of covering the ground, and like everything in wartime, once you've covered the ground, you've taken the what you wanted to take, and that was it. And from there onwards, it was a case of movement in bulk.
Did you see much of German civilians?
Well, you saw in the villages, you saw normal... families doing their little bits of farming, what have you. You didn't see it. There was nobody sort of in shops. Well, not that it's infantry people. Very sort of went into big towns very much anyway. That was all done earlier on by other troops. We didn't go into any big cities as such for battle. We battled in the open, as most light infantry regiments do. The other stuff is left to either sort of die away of its own will or knowing very well that there's no troops there. If tanks pass through, they say sort of the others give in. They know very well there's no troops in there, so they just bypass it and say, oh, well, it'll die its own death. And eventually, what we would refer to as mopping up arrangements are left by people going into a village prepare for a battle and finding that all the Germans come out with hands on their heads. They've given it up as a bad job. As time went on during the war, I mean, as far as I remember, looking back now, there, after Holland, there was very few battles, if any, in Germany itself.
Where did you push through to in the end?
Pardon?
Where did you finally end up?
Well, we after we'd done Arnhem, we went down, Arnhem was, as I say, by this time was clear, but we had gone down the east side of the Rhine and had got down quite a way down. At the same time, we had to back tracks back on certain places because nobody had called on to clear it or to ensure that there were no Germans there. And eventually, at the very end of the war, ending of the war, we sort of landed right into Germany, into the areas of Belsen, places like that. North Germany, at one time we went for a battle to in the north of Hamburg, for instance, Neumünster area, to find nobody at all. And the whole of the Neumünster area was all free. So we had, in actual fact, been by this time, of course, we had the soft skin vehicles, the three tonners and the one tonners, to carry the troops, knowing very well that literally, although we hadn't been given the word, the Germans had more or less given up. So in turn, we were ordered to go to certain places by the hierarchy, take up a position here or go to that place. And we landed up at a place farther north of Hamburg, in the Bremerhaven area, so to speak. And then from there, we were told to just be on skin vehicles, three tonners, and we moved a considerable distance away, right down as far as Belsen concentration camp area.
Did you go into Belsen?
We went into Belsen. We were one of the first troops in Belsen, in fact. When we arrived in Belsen concentration camp, they had the open graves. We actually saw the bodies in the open graves, large open graves, I'm talking about mass graves. And, of course, the stench was quite considerable. And in actual fact, I was one that went to with another, I think by this time, I don't know where I had been made. Yeah, I was a full sergeant, that's right. But I moved in with this company sergeant major, Sampson, I always remember his name, big chap, and we went in to what was known as the gas chambers. And when we got into this area, there was a concrete area covered with grass, etc. And when we moved in, as if you wanted to go round to go in to see what was in there, you couldn't, because there was a little track around it and it had iron doors on it. But in actual fact, through the slits in the armour of the doors, you could see all these bodies. Like, I mean, obviously it had been marched, closed the doors, and that was it, gas was put on. So we actually saw that. And at the same time, having saw that, they had open trenches with bodies still in. And that's only, well, what would it be? No more than 10 miles from Celle. This is right in the middle of Germany. So, as a matter of fact, that's about 14, 20 kilometres, I suppose, from Wolfsburg, where they made the Volkswagens. And there we split up and went to different companies, went to different villages.
Why had you gone into Belsen?
Well, I think this was to see what was there as far as German troops were concerned, just to make certain it was clear. But of course we didn't expect to find what we found.
Were there any of the victims still alive wandering about?
No. No, there might have been some victims, but I didn't see any personally. It was a sad. It was a sad look. A sad viewing. What we saw there was terrible. And, as a matter of fact, there were the open graves. You see, there were open trenches, sort of 6, 8, or 10 foot wide, and half as or just as deep, with the bodies actually in there. We actually saw the bodies in those trenches.
Who was in charge at the camp when you arrived?
I don't know. We didn't.
How long were you there for?
Oh, a very short space of time. Wasn't even there a night. We had to get outside, and we went to the little villages outside where there were hardly any men anyway. They were all in troops.
Now, you were in the occupation of Germany until 1948, according to your army service
record. That's right.
Whereabouts were you and what were you doing?
Well, after the war, when we started, we sort of got the battalion together as much as we could, so to speak. And we finished up in a town called Buxtehude, which is south of Hamburg. And in actual fact, that had been recently, before us, we are getting there, would had only been a matter of a short while, filled up by German troops. But they were pulled out, taken out as prisoner, obviously, by people that had got there before us. And we moved into this this camp and stayed there right until the end of the war, so to speak. It was gone. The war, by this time, had finished. Because when we went into the camp, what I was saying, Belsen, you see, that was at the end of the war. But we... peace, by this time, had been declared. The end of the war had been declared. That's how we kind of be the first into Belsen concentration camp, being in the small villages around, one company in each village. And from there, the battalion pulled out of the their respective villages and formed up in this barracks in the North Germany. As a matter of fact, there were the 4th Battalion and the 7th Battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry, in the same camp, in Buxtehude. The 7th, by virtue of their smaller numbers, I think, they disappeared, posted somewhere else, which I don't recollect, and we stayed there. In fact, the 4th Battalion, the Somerset Light Infantry, was disbanded in that camp at Buxtehude. When I say disbanded, the majority of them were posted to the another battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry that were in Austria.
What was the situation at Buxtehude?
Well, Buxtehude was a German camp, German barracks, built barracks, of a very good quality. And had been was in excellent condition. It had seemingly not been attacked during the war, either by air or what. They'd had no battles as such there. And that's where the 4th Battalion, the Somerset Light Infantry, disbanded.
Were there any disturbances in the area from dispersed persons?
No, no.
How long were you at Buxtehude for?
I would think I would think we were there somewhere around 5 or 6 months, something like that.
But you stayed in Germany? Did you?
Well, I, because of the disbandment of the unit at Buxtehude, most of them went to Austria, to the 2nd Battalion or whatever battalion was down there. And those that were nearing the end of their time, for instance, they were not regular soldiers and continuing on, were disbanded and left Buxtehude. This is the time when I, because I had a time to go, I was posted to a unit which, as I say, the end of the war had been, had already arrived anyway, had gone by this time, it was a matter of months. And I was asked if I would go to a unit in Hamburg, only to find that when I arrived there, and remember, I was a company sergeant major at this time. I was the company sergeant major, we had quarter company of the 4th Battalion. And having come from B Company, like you do in a regiment, you go from one company to another, maybe, towards the end, which I did, and went to HQ. And I finished up, as I say, they asked me if I would go to a unit disbanding prisoners of war, which I thought, well, quite a nice change. I don't think I had signed on to say that I was going to be in the army for the rest of my life, which I finished up more or less doing. But I went to this disbanded control unit in the what was known as the Kunsthalle in Hamburg. The Kunsthalle, of course, is a museum which is next to the Hamburg main railway station, the Hauptbahnhof, which is on the Alster. And right at the side of the water is the Kunsthalle, and you go over a bridge there into St. Pauli, and where eventually I used to go across the bridge to the British Forces Network station, BFN, where Cliff Michelmore was at about that time. I don't know where he was there at that exact time, but he was there in that, actually, which is actually opposite the Hamburg prison and the area of St. Pauli, which is a noted night affair for the ladies. I didn't know that area at all, other than the only one thing that I remember there, that on the turning outside of the what was the British Forces Network office, in the middle of the road is the big statue of the Bismarck, and you turn right and went down to St. Pauli, which was a noted thing which I didn't have the wish to go, and I didn't have the opportunity anyway to go down to see what it was like down there. So I was there in the Kunsthalle for, yeah, I suppose a year or something like that, disbanding, and the only Englishman, incidentally, when I say only, the only sergeant major there, and I had a captain and a major, English, with, I think, a driver and a couple of other lower-ranked soldiers. And we did the disbanding of the all the prisoners, German prisoners of war, that had come back from Russia and was stationed in Schleswig-Holstein area. And I would hazard a guess that between Hamburg, which I, the only job I did was to sign their certificates. That's the only, that was my job. We had a doctor and a couple of interpreters, which were Dutch in the main, in the team, and I was the signatory of all the people that got discharged from that office. And I would hazard a guess that over the period of time, because I went from there afterwards to Hanover and did the same thing there, in charge of signing these certificates. And I reckon I must have signed probably a couple of million, I suppose.
How did you know who to give a certificate to?
Well, we had there was a team, complete team of interpreters, doctors, myself, and we had about 20 young ladies, all English speaking, that did all the paperwork. And all these people were assembled in the local town hall, what have you, like we would have little clubs here. They would assemble at a time given by having paper, the actual poster made by local printers, which of course by this time had got on their feet, had the posters made and they were pinned to the local drill hall or what have you. There, the burgomaster's office or something like that, they had a board outside which they'd have one of these things pinned up. And it had to take the prisoners by their initial of their name, their forename, their surname. Anyone that had come from Russia or Germany all had to receive their discharge papers. And they got their discharge, and either if they were an ex-officer, I think they got 80 Deutschmarks, and if they were a soldier, they got 40. And they were actually given their money and their certificate, duly stamped, signed by me, and that allowed them as a opened a civilian life, and they made their own way to wherever they were going, which they were asked by the British units to help them, because a lot of them were not in a, what you call a 100% fit state, but they managed to be able to put one foot in front of the other within reason, and help them on their way. And by doing that, I forget what it was we gave them. We gave them a disc with some mark on it, and they had it put over their and tied around their waist. And if they were actually on a route, they were told by every British unit was told that if they saw one of these persons with that sign on, they were bound to stop. There was a reason for their having to stop to pick them up. And they took them as far as they were without going off, of course. According to them, they could drop them off again, and somebody else would pick them up and take them on. This was due to the unfit state that they were in the main, because they were all ex-prisoners. They'd been in concentration camps and all sorts of things. So they were eased on their way by virtue of this particular thing that they had to put over the cloth material thing. And everybody took to it. As normal, you saw people stopping and actually picking them up. And as I say, I went to Hanover and did the same thing, and that's where I finished up there, doing that job. And from
what impression did the German POWs make on you?
Well, I think I looked upon it myself as an individual, that they were after all soldiers. They did the same thing that what I had to do. They were given orders to do whatever they had to do, and they did it to the best of their ability. I had no animosity towards them. I mean, naturally, when the war started, a different thing, but when you see them in the state that I saw them, and like a lot of others other than myself saw them, I think you have to credit them with they were only doing what they were told.
What state were they in?
Some of them were in very bad, certainly mental bad state, and health-wise, not brilliant. But of course, at all the centres that we were doing these discharges, we always had a doctor who went over them and saw and made out forms that they should take to their local doctor.
What exactly do you mean by their mental state?
Well, some of them were had been shell-shocked, and goodness gracious me, you know. But they, obviously, in a lot of cases, as far as I saw it, they didn't want to be sort of held back. They wanted to get home. That's what they wanted to do. So they were prepared to put on the act, if there's any act to put on, to try to be fitter than what they in actual fact were, purely to get, because they were told, they knew that they could get picked up if they were en route. They had a state of routes, you see, A, B, C, D, E, F route, and that's the sort of the number they had. And all the English drivers were told through their regiments that it was forbidden for them to pass them. They just had to pick them up, irrespective of what they thought, whether they had any likeness for German or not. They were ordered to pick them up, because they probably wouldn't have made it if they hadn't had that facility.
Do you think the English soldiers obeyed that?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Where did you go to after Hanover?
After Hanover, I went to, in charge, by this time, of course, I'd been made a company sergeant major way back, and I went to the what was known as the local Arbeitsamt, which is to us labour exchange. And I took over from a captain there. I was a warrant officer class 2.
Is this in Hanover?
No, this was in the famous place called Hameln, or Hameln, as it's spelt, H-A-M-E-L-N, where Irma Grease had her trial. That's where I met the great Albert Pierpoint.
How did you come to meet him?
Well, I met him because it was one of my sort of responsibilities to look after anyone of officer status to make certain that they were given accommodation and facilities in the local officers' or warrant officers' mess equivalent. In this case, it was an old hotel that had been turned into sort of an officers' mess area for people like him, held in high esteem by the authorities, because he was only called upon to go out there to do the necessary job. And he is the one that then eventually hung Irma Grease, who was, I believe, in saying that she was the last, I think.
Did you speak to him?
I spoke to Albert, yes, yes. But not on a sort of a friendly basis. He, as I understood from the local hotelery, played with knife, forks and spoons the night before he did the necessary business the following morning in the prison.
He played with them?
Played, yeah. He put them in certain positions, you know, on a table. And
what was the idea of doing that?
I don't know. I don't know whether it was sort of time-consuming or what. But it was just a little thing that went in his mind, because he didn't tell me how or why or where from, but confirmed more or less that that's what he did. It's one of those best things best known to himself, I suppose.
What did he look like?
Well, put it bluntly, a bit like sort of butcher-like type of man. Red face, plumpish chap. You know. Of course, I did my part as a WO in charge of the... I was only concerned that he was well catered for and had the necessary accommodation. That was my job. But, I mean, he... Because he